session number 23787, reel 5.
Major Dillon, reel 5. Now, you'd had this accident. What was the immediate aftermath? I mean, you ran into the stone and broke pelvis. Were you trapped?
The Jeep fell across my back and rolled over. I lay immobile. The patrol got the Jeep back on its wheels. We got somehow up to the top by an easier route. Our fitter discovered the chassis of the Jeep was cracked. He repaired this with an angle iron picket and some signal wire. He discovered that the sump plug had been knocked out. He repaired this with my shaving brush, which he trimmed down, wrapped in red lead and a bit of cotton, and banged in with a hammer. It says a lot for a Jeep. The whole thing held together. And the fitter, of course.
And what state were you in? I mean, were you in a lot of pain?
Funnily enough, not, but just paralysed, virtually no feeling, but couldn't do anything. I couldn't move anything below my waist. And for instance, to have a pee or a shit, Trooper Bransgrove had to hold me up. And there we were, and I decided we'd have to abandon the patrol and endeavour to get back to Tripoli, which we assumed, we didn't know because we didn't have a radio, we assumed had been captured.
And what do you remember of that journey? It must have been...
Well, again, the navigation thing was important, and I made an appreciation that since I was not the only patrol in the area, the Germans were now well alert, and they'd be looking for us. Again, exploit the Jeep's mobility, stick to the roughest possible ground. Germans didn't have vehicles capable of following us. So we made our way across very rough ground in a generally easterly direction. One patrol very nearly spotted us, but we saw it first, fortunately, and lay for about 6 hours, like that, just below the... And they didn't see us, and it came dusk, they moved away. We moved on, and suddenly, right across the horizon, spread a string of armoured cars. Oh, God, look at them. They look like ours. So we crept forward, more or less with our hands up, and it turned out that they were the armoured car screen of the 8th Army, King's Dragoon Guards, who looked at us with grave suspicion. However, they said, yes, Tripoli has been taken, and they helped escorted us back into Tripoli, where I was interviewed by a staff officer, and I gave him my report, such as it was. I was evacuated to hospital in Cairo by air.
How long were you in hospital?
About 6 weeks, I think. Funny enough, it turned out that the fracture was more cracks than fracture, and it repaired fairly quickly. I returned to what was left of the regiment. In fact, virtually the SAS from then on ceased as far as Western Desert was concerned, because the desert had ceased. So what to do? And I cast around, for a time served with Lieutenant Roger Keyes in an MTB, which is part of SOE, which I'd never heard of at the time.
Now tell me about that. That sounds unusual.
Well, I'd met him on a course. I went on a course during this period. They sent me on a course at Jerusalem.
Which came first? The course came first.
The course came first, where I met Keyes. And the course was run by a most extraordinary chap, Major Grant Taylor, who'd been a G-man in America. Before that, he'd been a Shanghai policeman and had trained the G-men. And he was our small arms instructor for pistol shooting. And he's the one who told me, boy, there are only two sorts of pistol shot, quick ones and dead ones. And I met this chap on this course, and I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm driving an MTB. I said, well, that sounds fun.
Now, what exactly was the course about? Who was running the course? What was it
Grant
for?
Taylor, it was for special force personnel, pistol shooting, basically. All forms of pistols, both our own and American and foreign. And
about what time of the year are we in now? I'm slightly losing track. Still in 43?
Yes, just beginning of 43, sort of. Yes, beginning of 43. Because I went into Greece in March 43, so it was before that.
So around about January, 43.
Yeah.
This pistol, and you, what about the period in the MTB? Do you know the number of the MTB?
MTB 60, Lieutenant Roger Keyes. And really we did very little except we trained, we did a bit with the now, by now formed Special Boat Service, which was George Jellicoe's, he formed it. And the only thing they had in those days were rubber dinghies and goatly canvas boats. And because George was a bit of a ladies' man, his outfit was known as Jellicoe's Rubber Intruders. Which I don't know whether that's printable or not, but anyway, he wouldn't mind.
And what? So, hang on, was MTB 60 part of the Special Boat Service? Or
no, it was part of, it was attached to SOE, and its mission was, although I never actually did any, it was taking agents into Crete and the islands, because it was very fast and it could be silent.
And how were you linked with the Special Boat Service then? What was your connection?
Well, in that they sprung out of the residue of the SAS, because the SAS had virtually ceased after Tripoli. Stirling was captured. Most people were killed or captured. The only sort of snivelling people like me who managed to get away and survive.
But the Special Boat Service, that
the Special Boat Service didn't exist at that stage, but it was formed out of George Jellicoe, I suppose perhaps because his father had been an admiral, thought, well, the desert's finished, we'd best take to the water. And they did, and out of that came the Special Boat Service, which exists to this day. The idea of raiding the islands and all that sort of thing.
And what about what you were doing on MTB 60? What do you remember of that? Were you doing?
Well, I suppose I was a spare file. I was a supernumerary officer, and I was a yachtsman. I could navigate. I could, and I don't know whether this ought to appear in print, but I discovered, going into port once, Roderick, he said, "What's the colour of that light?" I said, "Well, God, you should know. You're the bloody captain." He said, "Well, I don't. I'm colour blind." Anyway.
What was Roger Keyes like? Was that the son of the Admiral?
It's the son of the Admiral, the brother of Geoffrey Keyes, VC. You know Geoffrey Keyes of the Rommel Raid? This was the younger brother, who was still alive. And his son Charles lives up the road, my godson.
And what was he like?
He, Roger Keyes, is my son's godfather.
What was Roger Keyes like? Can you give us a sort of pen picture of it?
He said he always tended to be in trouble. He said, "My trouble is, when you have a father who's Admiral Keyes of Zeebrugge and a brother who's Lieutenant Colonel VC, they're always looking to see what you're going to do." And he said, "Every time I bring my ship alongside, knock some paints off it, I get into trouble." I said, "Bloody idiot Keyes doesn't know what he's doing." So he said he suffered from being born under a great oak tree, if you know what I mean. And he rather like the Curious Eggs. He was very good in parts, but anyway, he's still alive.
Now, so were you going out on actual? I mean, you didn't actually take any.
We didn't actually. My time with the MTB did later on, but whilst I was, we didn't actually do any operations.
So you were just training, or
training, and we seemed to be being sent from Mersmatru to Beirut to back to Alexandria. We were in and out, and
doing what while you were?
Well, I suppose trading. And that ended. I was sort of sent for the residue of SAS. They were trying to sort people out, and I was called back to Cabrit. What to do? And they said, "We don't know, old boy. It's a sort of Sauve-qui-peur situation." And I got the name of one or two SOE people in Cairo and went and I knocked on the door. And there was the chap who ran the Kaiki service, which the MTB belonged to, Skipper Poole, Captain Poole. I said, "Any chance of getting a permanent job with your outfit? Because I know a bit about boats." And he said, "I'm full up at the moment, but the Greek section upstairs wants somebody. I'll send you up if you like." I mean, this is how it was done in those days. I was interviewed. They said, "Do you know anything about Lewis bombs?" I said, "Yes. SAS used for blowing up aeroplanes." "Well, we have a chap in Greece, wherever that might be, who has access to German airfields around Athens, but he knows very little about explosives. Would you like to go and join him?" I said, "Well, if you insist." That was on a Tuesday. By Friday, I was in Greece.
Now, we've just looked, and in the book it seems to be June 43. Yes. And that
may be about, I might have been a bit sooner, but anyway, spring 43.
And what preparations were made before you were dropped in?
I was interviewed by Brigadier Keeble, who you may have, who was quite a notorious chap, and I, again, with my sort of regular officer mind working, looked at the map on his wall and said, from my dropping area to Athens, I work out to be about 180 miles. You want me there? How am I supposed to get there? He said, you can't take train, old boy. The Germans run the trains, and the roads are rather dangerous. They tell me they walk across the tops of the mountains. That was my briefing.
Do you remember anything else that was said? Or, you know,
that was about all was said, except what weapons did I like? I was invited down to the Army to select my weapon.
And what did you select?
I select a long barrel Smith & Wesson 455 revolver.
So why did you pick that?
Well, I've been told by the pistol shooting instructor, whose name now escapes me for a moment, that it was the best weapon.
And what other weapons did you take?
That was all.
That's all.
Yep. The only equipment I had on me when I dropped was a pistol, a compass, essential, some binoculars, a bottle of gin, and 25 girl sovereigns.
Now, when did you learn to parachute?
With the SAS, I was halfway through one course and the Benghazi raid came. I came back and finished the course at Rabat David in Palestine. So I was parachute trained.
What do you remember of your parachute training, just to drop it in?
Well, by the time I did it, it had become much more sophisticated, that you weren't required to jump out of the back of a lorry going at 30 miles an hour, because they found that more people were injuring themselves being trained than ever were hurt in battle. So it was physically fairly intense, that you had to be fit, but it was basically physical training and jumping and getting on with it. You know, there was not so much you must be able to stand in your head and be terribly tough or anything. And there was one chap, he was a naval medical officer going to Yugoslavia, only had one leg. And parachuting, he used to take it off and tuck it under his arm. I said, why did they? So I don't want to bend it. Screw it off, he got tired.
So you've done that. Yeah. What about this Lewis bomb?
The Lewis bomb.
Tell us a bit about that.
There was a Captain Lewis who, there is a book his son has got brought out. Lewis really was more a founder of the SAS than Davis Turning. He was a sapper officer, explosives expert, and the Lewis bomb he designed to throw into the cockpits of airplanes. You know, the SAS did these aerodrome raids. You could shoot the thing up, but more effectively was to put a bomb in the cockpit or somewhere, or stick it on, and it was a ball about as big as a cricket ball or slightly bigger, a plastic explosive laced with magnesium powder, with a detonator and an igniter in it, and a fuse with a time pencil. And you press the time pencil through it, either stuck it on the aeroplane, on the engine, or in the cockpit, or wherever, and then made off, and bang, bang, and away they went. It was quite a simple device.
Were they dangerous?
Until you press the time, because, you wouldn't even introduce a pencil to it. It was perfectly inert until you detonated it.
Now, anything else before you left?
It was for a day or two. You were put in the care of the procedure with SOE. You were put in the care of a conducting officer. I don't say he actually slept with you, but bloody nearly made certain who you were sleeping with. And watched you like a bloody hawk, because you've been briefed, you see.
And who was George?
I can't remember his name, actually. I mean, he'd come out to dinner with you, if you went to a nightclub or anything. I was in there a few days, so it didn't apply very much, but that was the procedure. And he accompanied you up to the airfield, which was Derna, from where I was dispatched, and you were then handed over to a dispatcher. Sounded rather ominous.
So what did the dispatching? Was it the dispatcher?
The dispatcher was normally a staff sergeant, probably RAF, parachute trained chap, and his task. And you'd say, for God's sake, make sure, don't worry, sir, I'll make quite certain you leave this aircraft at the right moment. Because it was a point of honour, you know, chap did get cold feet sometimes, but the dispatcher was, he was right behind you, down you went, you know, you'd gone.
Now, what sort of aircraft were you on?
I went, on the parachute course?
No, sorry, when you actually...
Halifax, four-engine bomber.
What's your memory of the flight?
There were two of us, another fellow called Dickinson. I remember being rather perturbed. The pilot was an Australian sergeant who was smoking. I gather now that that's quite an order for a pilot of an airplane to smoke, but I was rather perturbed, I would say. But he said, that's all right, old boy. Relax, we'll let you. And I'd asked him to drop me at about 600 or 800 feet, which was, you know, the operation, because you're sufficiently high for the parachute to open, but sufficiently low, nobody can get much chance of seeing you. By the time I jumped out, it was a brilliant moon. We must have been at, I don't know, thousands of feet high, because I could see half of Greece in the bright moon. And it was as high as this. I had time to get my compass out of my belt, and I could see some signal fires, or assume they were signal fires on the horizon. And took a bearing on and got my compass back in my belt and buttoned it up before I landed. So it must have been pretty bloody high. However, the other chap with me, he agreed that it was over that way, so we marched in that direction.
Well, what was the sort of terrain that you'd landed
in? Rough. I landed in a tree on the edge of a cliff. Parachute fortunately caught in the tree. I shinned down. I had to leave the parachute up the tree, which, you know, you're not supposed to, but I couldn't get it down.
And you hadn't hurt yourself?
No. And a funny trick of nerves, the other fellow, we found each other, walking down this track, there was a wire, apparently, stretched tight across the track, and I thought, mines, it's a minefield. Never think why the hell there should be a minefield on top of a mountain. Anyway, thought we'd better explore this wire, follow it along to the end. Do you know what was on the end of the wire? A goat. Relief, sudden relief.
How far away from you was the chap you dropped with?
Oh, within a few hundred yards. We were within hail. We shouted. We heard each other.
Now, but can you tell us a bit about him? His name again?
His name was Dickinson.
His first name?
He was known as Dick. I can't remember.
Dickinson. Was he a lieutenant?
He was a captain. I was a captain at the time.
And what was his... why had he been dropped in...
I'm not absolutely certain. Actually, it was one of the things you didn't ask.
But that's
and he was dispatched to a different area. I did meet him subsequently during the occupation, but didn't... We separated, having landed.
Now, what happened there? You'd had this fright with a goat.
Eventually we discovered some bodies wrapped in blankets around the remains of a fire, so I shook one, and a bearded figure jumped up and shoved his rifle in my face. It was a partisan. And one of them spoke, and he said, we were expecting you, but we thought nobody would drop because we heard the aeroplane go away, so we went to sleep. So they guided us down to the village where there were two British officers, Colonel Arthur Edmonds and Harry McIntyre, who they had just done blowing up the Assiniboine Bridge, or McIntyre had, and they welcomed us with open arms, and they were very pleased to see my bottle of gin, which was consumed before breakfast.
Now, what were these two chaps like? Colonel Arthur Edmonds
was a New Zealander, great chap.
And what was his role in the organisation?
He was one of the senior. He was a second in command, I think, at the time of. The organisation was then sort of building from fragments.
And what was he like as a man?
Physically tough, delightful character, engineer by training, and Harry McIntyre, who, well, his story comes out later, eventually became...
He was a captain, was he?
Captain. MCRE. Was one of the chaps who helped blow the Assipos Bridge.
Now, what was the state of the organisation when you joined them? I mean, you know...
Very difficult to find out, because it was sort of cellular, if you like. You didn't know.
Can you just explain what that means? I mean, I know it's fairly obvious, but can you just explain? There were individual groups.
Some were responsible to a headquarters in Greece. I've got a diagram in my folio there of how it worked. Some, like myself, reported direct to Cairo and had very little other than advice and help from people on the ground. It was a kind of ad hoc arrangement. Some stations were individually controlled from Cairo. Some were part of a group which were controlled from a senior officer within the country. I was outside that, except for advice and help. Because I was sent right down to Athens. I was more or less away from the main body.
Now, you had a drink of gin with them.
And all that. And then...
Well, did they brief you at all?
Yes. They knew roughly what I was supposed to do, which was to find Don Stott, was the New Zealand officer, who again was the Assipos Bridge chap, who'd got access to the aerodromes, that I was to find him. And I was given guides and advice and help, and I had a day's rest and then set off in a southeasterly direction towards Athens.
You had a guide with you then?
Yes, a Greek guide. Greek guide.
Tell me about the journey. What was it like?
What one thought one was fit, but having been in the desert, you were very brown and lean, but most of your movement had been done in either a tank or a jeep. You're now on your feet, boy, or on a mule or a horse, and you were very footsore and weary till your feet got broken in, as it were. So the first day or two, one was pretty tired. And of course, the Greek mountaineer shepherds, they were as fit as fleas. They could run like anything.
And what was the sort of terrain you were going across? Was it still in this
mountain? Mountains. Wooded mountains.
And was there much... Where were the Germans?
The main towns were garrisoned, and there were German patrols, but the mountain areas, the remote mountain areas... were empty, actually. You could move about in uniform fairly freely.
And how long did the march go on for? It says about 10 days here, but
no, I don't think it took me as long. I think it was. I don't believe it was as much as a week. About a week, or whatever, however many. And what it tells you there, I think. Do I need to elaborate on that? Getting down towards Athens, round the corner in the track, I came upon a figure sitting on a log whittling a stick. And it was Geoffrey Gordon Creed, who I'd last seen at Benghazi. And he said, "They told me you were about a boy, I assumed you'd be along quite soon." And I told him what I was about, involved with this Don Stott in the aerodrome. He said, "I shouldn't bother to go any further. He's been evacuated to Cairo." And I can tell you the story of his evacuation.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
He suffered a mastoid, you know, a mastoid on the ear, and our little village doctor, who I didn't know at that time, had diagnosed this condition. He said, "If you're not operated on within 3 or 4 days, you will die." I can't operate. I've only got a bottle of iodine and some aspirins and things. However, my friend is the surgeon at the German officer's clinic in Athens. I can get you admitted there. He was admitted as the Romanian liaison officer. The only person who knew who he was the surgeon and the matron. Everybody else was a German officer. He was operated on, and he was kept behind the screens, and every time the German commandant came round, the surgeon said, "He's far too ill, Captain Stodka," or whatever they called him, "for you to see him, sir. Perhaps tomorrow he'll be better." So he passed by. After he'd been there about 10 days, the surgeon said, "Don, Your wound is now healed sufficiently. It's time for you to leave. This afternoon, when everybody's asleep, Matron will come. She's got your clothes. Get yourself dressed. Get out of bed. You will feel very weak because you've been in bed all this time. Matron will help you to the door. There will be a car waiting. The driver knows where to go, and the best of luck. And he got back to Cairo. So Jeff didn't know that story at that time, and he says, no good going any further down there because Donna's gone.
So what did you decide to do?
I stayed with, Jeff said, because he was senior to me, he'd been there sometime, I said, I suggest, and I clear this with Cairo, that you stay with me because operation, was it Noah's Ark? It's in the book.
Animals.
Animals is imminent.
Now what was Operation Animals?
Animals was part of the deception plan to make the Germans think that we were going to invade the Balkans and not Italy.
And how was it to work?
Create maximum confusion and blowing of bridges and railways and mining roads to make the Germans, and ambushing trucks and taking prisoners, and make the Germans think that we were the advance part, we were the raiding force, preliminaries to the invasion. And it worked. The Germans reinforced Greece with two or three divisions.
What was Gordon Creed? What was the size of his force, so to speak? Can you just
really no force. We didn't have a force. He was himself, radio operator and an interpreter. Who was I remember him well. He was a Greek language professor from Athens.
And what was it? Did your force or section have a name?
It had code names. Now he was. Oh God. I can't remember his code name at the moment. I should be able to, but I can't.
But your
mine was Lillian, a play on Dillon. I was Lillian. It had been Kincraig before when Don Stott had commanded it before, my area, which I went to later. They changed the name to Lillian, which remained Lillian Station for the rest of the war. And Jeff's was, oh God. I honestly can't remember at the moment. I should be able to.
Now, who were the? Can you tell us a bit more about the radio operator and the interpreter?
He was Sergeant Wilmot, Royal Corps of Signals, regular soldier, enlisted as a boy. As all the radio operators were outstanding, they had to be CODIS and operators. We used the one-time code signal system, which you probably know about.
Well, tell us a bit more about Wilmot, and then we'll move on to.
Well, he was a young sergeant, operator, radio operator. So he was the only British soldier that Jeff had with him was Sergeant Wilmot.
Now, what codes? Tell me about the codes they used. Did you know them yourself?
No. So I knew how it worked. I could explain how it works.
Could you do that for us?
You each have a book, any book, a novel. Cairo has the same novel, Athens in the Wartime, or Cairo on Fire, or whatever. To start your message, you send in clear a number. That is the page of that book, page 205. Another number, line 16. And then another, and two more numbers, another page, another line. You take the line and write across the top of your paper whatever it says. There I was, nothing on. And then down the other way, and you write your message in the middle in plain and pick the letters out from the, if you follow me, from that way and that way. So each letter goes out as a bigram. Totally random, and unless you've got that book and the page and the line, you can try forever. You're not going to decipher the message. In any case, you only need to use that page once. It's known as a one-time pad. It is very secure. It's disadvantage because it's very slow, both to encipher and to decipher at the other end. So it behoves you to keep your message short if you could.